Here's the way that the beat goes on sounded when we first heard it. La-di-da-da-da. Yeah, I said, uh-oh. The third line I came up with was...
The beat goes on.
They were the stone cold rock and roll professionals, and there may never be a group of that caliber again.
It's The Fake Show. Now here's Jim Tofty.
What the Funk Brothers did for Motown, the Swampers did for Muscle Shoals, the Wrecking Crew did for the West Coast Sound. An impressive list of Record of the Year Grammys went to the Wrecking Crew recordings. Now, after several years in the making, the documentary that tells the story of the greats behind the greats is out for all to see and hear. On the show with me now from Los Angeles is the director of the Wrecking Crew music documentary, Denny Tedesco, whose dad, Tommy, was the heart and soul of the Wrecking Crew.
Hello.
Denny, how are you?
I'm good.
I love this documentary. I've already watched it a couple of times. I watched it on the plane the other day and then again last night. And the challenge just to get it released was immense, was it not?
Yeah, it was huge. I mean, it was basically, it was, you know, it was until I could pay off all the licensing, there was no way it was ever going to get released. So for many, many years, you know, I just kept going, hoping that someone would come in and help us, but no one ever did. So we had to do it on our own. Then we had to get donations.
And because I kept hearing about it, I kept hearing that you were taking it to different film festivals and you were getting to the point where you had to take out loans and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we kept, you know, getting, we did, because before the festivals, that's how we got it made. We just kept, you know, refi, credit card, got to that point where, okay, now what? You know, we better make this film. And we cut the film together, get into the festivals, did, you know, paid for those rights, and then did extremely well in terms of popularity and as well as reviews. But until we could, you know, release it, that mean anything. And then no one was touching it because it was going to be so much money for any distributor to release it. We've had to pay this much, you know, so much rights and everything. They would never make the money back.
So did you eventually have to go to some sort of crowdfunding, like a Kickstarter?
In a sense, we did. The first few years, we didn't. We did it through a 501c where people would donate. We would come up with ideas of donation. We had people, you know, different levels, you know, groupie level, roadie level, A&R level, you know, created some kind of, people then dedicated songs. You know, if you dedicate a song, you put your name up on the song, like, you know, but basically when someone said to me, he said, oh, listen, why don't you do a dedication chapter? So what do you mean? He said, you know, like, it was a guy in radio who said, I'll give you $1,000 now if I could dedicate Up It Away as the song. And he said, just like a person dedicates a brick in a building, I'll do that. I said, that's a very cool idea. He said, yeah. So that's what I started doing, is dedications. People would, you know, make dedications to their loved ones or whatever, pick a song or write something out. And that's how it started.
And so was that something that would show up in the film, in the credits or something?
It doesn't show up in the film because there's way too many. Some of the songs, on the end, when I give credit to the songs, I'll say dedicated by blah, blah, blah. But in the actual DVD and actual on the website, if you go there now, you can see some of the people's dedications. And it got to be really fun because then towards the end, I was determined, like, oh, God, this song, no one's touched this song. I can't believe no one's, you know, picked Jerry Lewis's Everybody Loves a Clown. Well, who's going to dedicate that song?
Yeah. You
know? So I ended up, that's my favorite story, is I ended up at that point calling a clown school and pitched them the idea, and the guy gave me $1,000.
Unbelievable.
And it's great because the dedication he put was Everybody Is a Clown.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it was fun.
Can you describe, for those who don't know, who, if it's possible, to describe who the Wrecking Crew were and are?
Sure. I mean, the Wrecking Crew were session musicians in the early 60s in Los Angeles. They weren't a set group. It was just a nickname that came later. And the nickname comes from a story where the older guys said, these guys are going to wreck the business, play rock and roll. So these were the guys. And they basically went from recording session to recording session 3 or 4 times a day and just kept knocking out songs and recordings. And many of those became hits. So these were the folks that did the recordings for Sinatra, Beach Boys, Jan and Dean, Mamas and Papas, Fifth Dimension, The Byrds, Elvis, anything that was done in Los Angeles for a long time had effects of these guys on it.
The individual stories for each of these elite players, they each have their own story to tell, including your dad, Tommy Tedesco, who was the guitar player for a lot of these sessions. And he came from, what was it, the East Coast?
Dad and Mom came from Niagara Falls, New York, and they came out by accident. My dad actually went to a dance at Niagara University and happened to find out that the guitar player was leaving. Dad got to audition that night and then got the job and then went on the road the next day. Then got to Dallas and then got fired because they downsized. They got rid of him and as well as the singer so that they could, you know, have one guy. So my father's pride was so damaged that he didn't want to go back to Niagara Falls, New York. So he said to my mom, "Let's go to Hollywood. Hey, there's work there probably." So they moved in 1953. And I asked my mom, I said, "How long was it? A year? Year and a half?" She said, "No, it was 3 weeks." Literally came home after getting fired and he said, "Let's go."
Prior to your dad's passing, and I know that this is something, one of the reasons you wanted to do this film is to talk to him when he was still well enough to be part of this whole process and interviewing people. And it's just really a great scene in this movie. The round table discussion with your dad, Carol Kay, Plaz Johnson, Hal Blaine, reminiscing, each had their own different story. And I really liked how they talked about working with Brian Wilson and in particular, sessions like Good Vibrations.
We like to work for him. The word was, "Do you have the date with Brian Wilson tomorrow?" I said, "Yeah, I do." "Oh, good."
Well, Carol played on Good Vibrations and California Girls, and she was like the star of the show. I mean, she was the greatest bass player in the world, and she was way ahead of her time.
But he definitely wrote out some neat lines on the bass, like for instance, "I'd have never played that." Now, that's a jazz walking line. You knew that this kid was into something really, really great.
Right. And that came, when Dad got diagnosed with terminal cancer, I just thought, if I don't jump on this idea that I've always thought about, I wanted to tell the story of the Wrecking Crew. If I don't do it, it's going to be the biggest regret in my life. And so we jumped quick. And then Dad said, you know, I asked my father, "Who should we put at the round table?" And he told me, you know, he suggested those guys. And then we just kept, after Dad passed, then I kept filming other people, artists. And, you know, I knew the beginning, middle, and the end. I just didn't know how it was going to, you know, cut together. But we brought in a great editor and producer, Claire Scanlon, and that was in 2006.
And I know that you were getting to the point, I had read that you had almost too many people that you were interviewing that it could have made this movie 3-4 times as long, and they finally had to...
My editor said, "You got to stop interviewing."
Yeah.
And she said, "You'll never fall in love with anybody if we can't put everybody in." And I said, "Well, that's why God gave us DVDs." Joking, but I always wanted everybody's voice somewhere. And the goal was to have the best of outtakes of the guitar players, the bass players, the drummers, producers, engineers, artists. And I thought I had stopped interviewing a month and a half ago, and then last Friday I did Michael Nesmith. Yeah, so I'm be able to quickly cut something out of him and add him to the mix.
So you've already talked to him?
I was going to San Francisco for one of the screenings, and I thought, well, you know what? He's up in that area somewhere in Northern California. I thought, I'm going to try one more time, because I tried for years to get him. He said, "Yeah, great."
That's fantastic. I know Mickey Dolenz's comments in the film. He said, when you hear what they did, the final product with the Monkees songs, he goes, "There's no doubt that this was the best choice, even though their feelings were hurt or whatever, because they weren't playing."
Mike said, "Listen, I didn't know how to write a pop song. When they told me I couldn't play my own music, my ego got to me."
Right.
You know, he said, I'm not a good guitar player. I'm not a good singer. He said all those things.
Now, one thing, Denny, for the crew to record with bands like the Byrds, the Beach Boys, the Association, who were more their age, but what did a guy like Frank Sinatra think of these guys walking in with jeans and t-shirts? They were kind of scruffy.
I don't think Frank really didn't have any, don't forget these guys, yeah, they were 10 years, 15 years younger than, they were 10, 15 years younger than Frank, but Frank had such respect. Frank didn't care, you know. And it's interesting because Frank walked in, "Hey, guys," and he knew, like Hal Blaine, he knew, because Hal was Tommy Sands, his drummer. And Tommy Sands was engaged to Nancy for years, you know, or either married or engaged to Nancy. You know, so there was a relationship there. And then, like, even when my father, when he got married to Mia Farrow, my father was the trio that was at the the small wedding party.
Wow.
It would be so much fun if there was some stories there, you know.
I know. It's almost like you have another movie or two with all those stories.
But it's amazing. But no, I think Frank, and the thing is, all those other artists, when I asked about intimidation, I said, you know, were any of these artists intimidating? Like, Brian said, no. They said, all of them said, don't forget, when they're walking into the studio, these guys are kids. They don't have hits. You know, they don't have a lot of stuff going behind them. But when you walk in the studio and go, Frank Sinatra, well, then you're a little more, not on edge, but you're a little more, okay, on top of it. Because, you know, Frank's going to come in, he's going to do one or two takes, and you're going to get out of there. So you got to make sure you don't mess up.
And he's got the hat on and the suit.
It was great.
So is it safe to say that Phil Spector was the first to use these guys?
To be honest with you, it could be more Jan and Dean. Jan was using Earl Palmer, you know, and it's kind of like a mixture, who knows. And then what happens is Phil had Steve Douglas, who was, he was basically a contractor. And then, and that's how that started.
Was it the Wrecking Crew pretty much the backing band when it came to Jan and Dean when they were hosting the Tammy Show concert film?
Yeah, it was Jack, and she was, I think, the conductor or the music supervisor, whatever you want to call it. And then it was Hal Blaine, Leon Russell, my dad, Bill Pittman, Glenn Campbell. You could see them all in the orchestra. It's hilarious.
I know the Beach Boys were part of that show, too, and I'm wondering how these musicians, what they felt walking into the studios when Brian was producing the Pet Sounds album, which was, you know, arguably the greatest rock album ever.
But, you know, it sounds like listening to, doing the research and talking to a lot of people, that was not very well received at the beginning. You know, it was, you know, and don't forget, Brian's, you know, they're just putting things together haphazardly for a while. So I don't know if you don't know until later that it's going to be that classic.
I always heard that Capitol Records at the time said, hey, what happened to the car and surfing songs here? What are we getting into this serious relationship stuff? So you were in the film business for quite a while before this came about, kind of a...
I was in the film business in a sense. I was a grip and a lighting technician, and I was a decorator in the early days. And in my 80s, when I got out of school, I was in the art department. I wanted to write, you know, but I wasn't a writer. You know, I'm no more a writer than I was a musician. You know, a musician plays every day. He practices it, works at his craft. And the same thing happened to me. I thought I wanted to write, you know, wrote a few scripts, but nothing ever consistent. So I was doing other things, and that was one of the things that drove me crazy making this film. I did not want to quit. You know, there was a few reasons I couldn't quit. One, I had just put my whole family in jeopardy by pushing this film for the last, 18 years. You know, kept, investing to where you cross that line, you can't turn back. And I didn't want to quit out of, because I quit so many things in my life. But, well, the film has done so well in festivals, I got to keep going.
Yeah, you knew what you had with this, so I suppose you really had to.
I don't know if people want to say anything, but they're just thrilled. The emails and the response is phenomenal. Well, and I'm not saying this out of cockiness. I knew that was there because I'd been showing the film for 5 years around the country, around the world. So I've seen the response. It wasn't that I didn't know how the film would be reacted to. It was just, give me the opportunity, please, to get it out there. Until our distributor would join us, we were just doing it on our own. And I said something recently, I said, in the audience, I said, if there's a distributor out there, I would highly recommend you watch movies like these with audiences and don't pick and choose your 5 people in the office to watch it. Because you can't. Because you can't get a real judging moment.
You know, you talked about the music licensing and how expensive that was. Ultimately, how many songs, which are very important to this film, how many songs are in it?
110 songs, and I wasn't turned down by one. Everybody finally came around and helped, signed on.
And I tell you, it drives this film. It's great with all the interviews and everything else, but you really get a feel for how much work these guys were involved with.
That was the point I was striving at the beginning when people would say, before it had a cut, or even when I had a cut and I was still trying to pay these things off. They said, well, can't you just go with less music? I said, no, you can't. If I told you 5 songs or 5 artists, I said Supremes, Jackson 5, Temptations, Smokey Robinson, Marvin Gaye, what do you got? Instantly, it's Motown. I said, what do you got when you have Sinatra, the Beach Boys, Elvis, and the Birds and Fifth Dimension and the Chipmunks. What do you got? It was a business that was here, that was a factory. And you have to drive the fact that these guys did so much. And it's not just, you know, you have to figure out, okay, you know, it was a factory that sometimes a factory makes a Rolls Royce and sometimes it makes a Pinto.
Well, and you know, Denny, this was a time when record companies and producers had so much control, more than the artists, over the content of the finished recordings. Will we never see a time like that again?
Probably not, but not because it, like, oh, can't be the same. That was a necessity to have these people there because of technology. You know, when we only had one track, we needed guys to go in and go out. What was interesting is Stevie Van Zandt the other day did an interview with me, and he brought something up to me that, you know, I never thought about. He says, do you realize you're talking about songs that are 50, 60 years old? These songs were done within a couple hours, you know, recorded and mixed. And sometimes put out on acetate that day. Can you imagine? He says, we can't get that now. I can't. He says, it blows my mind to think to go into the studio and say, I only got an hour to do a song.
I think I heard an interview with you in the past where you said, you know, some of these bands maybe could have played some of these parts, but it would have taken them a couple weeks what it took your dad and Carol Kay and Hal Blaine to do in just an hour or two.
You know, Dad's 30 in 1960. So if he's working with the Beach Boys, you know, there's a big difference, you know, being 30 in the studios in 1960 than being 18. You know, he's got 15 years of experience or more on that guitar. And recording is a totally different thing than playing live. You know, so that it made a big difference.
And they were making things up, too, were they not? Were they not giving advice to some of these younger musicians?
Advice to the musicians as much as they would, whatever the parts were. It was up to them to, you know, to say, hey, you know, what about this to the producer? And they play something. Yeah, that sounds good. Let's do that. You know, but it depended on the piece. You know, you go in there hoping that you're going to make something. You always got to think you're going to make it the best you can.
Hal Blaine, the drummer, his story is pretty amazing because he's played on so many recordings. He talked about in the film being wealthy. He had a Rolls Royce, a mansion, a yacht, and then he lost it all because he had been married six times.
Yeah, the reason that story's in there is someone that's typical of anybody. You know, it wasn't always, some guys were married four times. My mom and dad they stayed together, fortunately, you know, and it wasn't like it was their marriage, you know, they stuck it out. They had their hard times, personal stuff, but they got through it.
So Hal Blaine, Carol Kay, and some of the others, are some of them still working today?
No, the only one still working is maybe Don Randy, Chuck Berghoffer, Joe Osborne plays occasionally. The last recording that Hal, Joe Osborne, Don Randy did together was the Glen Campbell song that was on the back of the documentary. And that's wonderful. It's You Won't Remember Me.
Do these studios, Western Recorders, Gold Star Studios, are they still standing in any form?
No. United Western is, in a sense, it's two different studios. One's called Ocean Way, and the other one's East West. And we actually did a screening there the other night, private screening, and a tour of the studio. That was fun. Capitol Records is still there, but Gold Star's long gone. You know, it's just a parking lot, just like everything else. Things move on.
And when will this be out on DVD with all of the extras? In June. The website is great, by the way, too. All of the bands that we heard in the 60s and 70s, part of this whole Wrecking Crew history lesson that fortunately you've been able to put up there after a challenging, what is it, a decade and a half?
So much said, it's almost two decades.
It's been great. And you can go to what, iTunes now, Denny?
Or video on demand in certain markets. We're in 100 cities now.
Are you in Las Vegas? Are you going to be in a theater here?
So it's not there yet. You know, it will be, but video on demand. It's funny because if you can see it live, it's great. But like a guy came the other night. He says, I rented it the other night, and then I came to see it with you guys. You know what I mean, like with the group of, you know, with, you know, the audience. And he says, oh my God, it's a different experience.
I advise everyone to go to the WreckingCrewFilm.com to find out about where it might be near you and anything upcoming regarding the project. Denny Tedesco, it was a great pleasure to talk to you today.
Thank you so much. We'll hopefully I'll see you in Vegas.
That would be great. And I will talk to you later. Bye. Thank you, buddy. Bye-bye. So once again, go to the Wrecking Crew website for all the information you need. They even have cool Wrecking Crew gear for sale. The film is on iTunes and on demand, possibly in a theater near you. I personally can't wait till June 16th, which is when it's out on Blu-ray with all of the extras. Thanks again for listening to The Fake Show. I'm Jim Tofte, and I'll be talking at you soon.
Thanks for tuning in to The Fake Show podcast. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow along on Twitter.